1844 Made Simple. Welcome to Part 3. Let's join Clifford Goldstein as we open our Bibles to Daniel Chapter 9.
Before we go to Daniel 9, I want you to remember something. Remember Daniel 2? Remember Daniel 2 consisted of a dream. A dream, and there was a complete explanation for that dream. Remember? Nebuchadnezzar had the dream. He didn't know what was going on. Daniel came by and he explained to him everything. Told him the dream, what the dream was, and now the head of gold, and the arms are this, and the belly and thighs are this, and the legs are this, and so on and so forth. So in Daniel 2, you have a dream and a complete explanation of that dream. Daniel 7, Daniel has a dream. Daniel has a vision. The four beasts come up, so forth. Then he's given an explanation. So he has a vision, whatever, and he gets an explanation. He's told that the one animal's this, the other animal's that, this animal's this, and so forth. And then there's going to be this judgment scene, and so forth. So like Daniel 2, Daniel 7 is a dream and a full explanation. Okay? Daniel 2, Daniel 7, both have dreams or visions, both have full explanations. When you get to Daniel 8, however, things are a little bit different in Daniel 8. What do we have in Daniel 8? Daniel had a vision, the ram, the goat, the little horn, the sanctuary being cleansed. Then Gabriel comes to give him an explanation of that vision. He explained to him the ram, he explained to him the goat, he explained to him the little horn. But what was the one thing in Daniel 8 that was not explained? The vision about the 2300 days. Remember Daniel says, and I was astonished at the vision of the evening and mornings, the vision of the 2300 days, it goes on, but I none understood it. And we'll look at that more closely. The point I'm trying to bring out here, and, oh, one other point. When we go to Daniel 9, as we're going to do, we're going to find something very interesting in Daniel 9. Daniel 9 has no dream. Daniel 9 has no vision. All you have in Daniel 9 is an explanation. Remember that. So Daniel 2, dream, vision, complete explanation. Daniel 7, dream, vision, complete explanation. Daniel 8, dream, vision, and a partial explanation. And we get to Daniel 9 and we look at Daniel 9, all we have is an explanation. And now that's what we're going to look at now, is Daniel 9. Now, the question is, what was Daniel 9 explaining? Now, if you read Daniel 9, the bulk of Daniel 9, the essence of Daniel 9 is really Daniel's prayer for the deliverance of Israel. He's praying for Israel. Verses 4 and 5, he says, O Lord, the great and dreadful God, keeping the covenant of mercy to them that love Him and that keep His, and to them that keep His commandments, we have sinned and have committed iniquity and done wickedly and have rebelled, even by departing from thy precepts and from thy judgments. Then later on, the prayer is for God to quote verse 16, to let thine anger and thy fury be turned away from the city Jerusalem, thy holy mountain. And that's basically the essence of what Daniel is praying in his prayer here. Now, the important point about Daniel's prayer is that nowhere in Daniel's prayer is Daniel asking for any kind of explanation. Nowhere in the prayer is Daniel saying, oh God, why did this happen? Why did that happen? Why did the Babylonians come down? Why is the temple destroyed? Why this? Why that? Nowhere is he asking for that. Is he asking for any kind of explanation? Daniel knows why all that has happened. Verse 16, he says, because of our sins and for the iniquities of our fathers, Jerusalem and thy people are become a reproach to all that are about us. So he knows why. So the point is, Daniel asked no questions in the prayer. He sought for no understanding. The last time we see Daniel not understanding something, the last time we see Daniel in darkness, not understanding, is in the end of Daniel 8, dealing with the vision of the 2300 days. It says, and I was astonished at the vision, and none understood it. Everything else in Daniel 8 was explained, except the 2300 days. So the last place we see Daniel not having an explanation is concerning the 2300 days. Now, what happens next? Daniel 9, verse 21. Yea, while I was... Daniel's praying, and then he goes like this. He says, yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. So who comes? Gabriel. Last time we saw Gabriel was in Daniel 8. Gabriel was the angel that came to Daniel in Daniel 8 to give him the explanation about the vision. Gabriel was told, make this man understand the vision. So you've got the same angel that Daniel had earlier. Daniel was referring back. He said, even the man Gabriel, who I had seen in the vision at the beginning. So he's pointing back the earlier vision. And Gabriel was the angel there. The same angel comes back to Gabriel again in Daniel 9. And remember, Gabriel was told, though, to make this man understand the vision in Daniel 8. The end of Daniel 8, not everything was explained. Now at this point, a quick look at the Hebrew is going to come very helpful to us. I'm not going to go into heavy Hebrew. I'm just going to bring out one or two words in the Hebrew, which I think will help make this thing all explained much more simpler for you. Two different words in Daniel are used for the word vision. Two different Hebrew words are translated the same word for vision. If you go to Hebrews, Daniel 8, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me. Next verse says, and I was in vision and I saw in vision. Okay? Now the word for vision there is chazon. Comes from an ancient Semitic word, chazar, to see a vision. Okay, so in verse 1, and I was in vision, chazon. I saw in the vision, chazon. And then Daniel goes on, he describes the vision. The ram, the goat, the little horn, sanctuary being cleansed. That's the word for vision there. If you look on your charts that you've got number 15, look up in the top corner, Daniel 8, 1 and 2, you'll see in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision, a chazon, appeared unto me, referring to a whole vision, a complete vision. That's the word for vision used in that part of Daniel. Now, when you go towards the end of that chapter, when you get to the chapter dealing with verse 26, Daniel 8, 26, the word vision is used there again. But you have another word for vision that's used there. Verse 26, the first part and the last part, and the vision of the evening and mornings. So he's talking specifically now about the 2300 evening and mornings. Okay, and the vision of the evening and mornings, which was told is true. Then if you look at the end of verse 26, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. Now the word for vision there, in both those parts of verse 26, and the vision of the evening and morning, which was told is true, the Hebrew word there is mare. It comes from the Hebrew word ra'ah, which means to see. Just to see. And sometimes it's translated in the Bible as appearance. In Genesis, Joseph was said to be beautiful of Mare. A lot of times in Hebrew, you take a verb and you stick a mem, that letter mem in front of it, and it becomes a noun. So you've got this word here for Mare, and the vision of the evening and mornings, and the Mare of the evening and mornings, which is told is true. And then he goes and ends the chapter, and I was astonished at the Mare, but none understood it. So that really, if you see that, it helps you understand in Daniel 8 that the part about the 2300 days was the part he did not understand. All the rest of the Hazon he understood, as we saw yesterday, because everything was explained to him very, very carefully, except the 2300 days. Anyway, two different words appear for vision in chapter 8. Hazon, referring to the whole vision of the chapter, and Mare, referring specifically to the part of the 2300 days that Daniel did not understand. Is this clear? Now, interestingly enough, when we go to Daniel 9, these two words for vision are used in Daniel 9. And when you see how they're used, it's very, very helpful. Let's look at that. Verses 21, 22. Yea, Daniel 9, 21 and 22. Yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, the angel he saw in Daniel 8, whom I had seen in the vision, in the Hazon, at the beginning, then he goes on and says, and he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. Remember, nowhere in Daniel's prayer is he asking for skill, is he asking for understanding. He understands. The last time he did not understand, we saw Daniel concern the 2300 days. So the same angel comes back, okay, and he points him back. Points him and says, I've come to give thee skill and understanding. And Gabriel says, the angel that I had seen in the Hazon, in the whole vision at the beginning. And now listen carefully. Now we read, I had noticed the specific part of the vision that Gabriel points him to. Verse 23. At the beginning of thy supplication, Gabriel says to him, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore, understand the matter and consider the Mare. Consider the Mare. The word there is translated vision, but the Hebrew word there is Mare. What Mare? Obviously, the Mare, the vision of the 2300 days that Daniel did not understand in chapter 8. Can you see that? He points them, you've got those two words in Daniel 8, you've got those same words in Daniel 9. He points them back to Hazon, the whole vision, and then specifically points him to the Mare and says, I've come to give you understanding. So we have the same angel interpreter as Daniel 8. Daniel himself points back to Gabriel when Gabriel appears to Daniel 8. Gabriel then promises to give Daniel skill and understanding. The last place Daniel did not have skill and understanding concern the 2300 days, and then the angel specifically points him back to the Mare, uses that word. It says, therefore, understand the Mare. Consider the Mare. If you look at your chart number 16, the corner of 16, O Daniel, I've come forth to give thee skill and understanding. Therefore, understand the matter and consider the Mare. Obviously, the Mare, the vision of the 2300 days that he did not understand. Is that clear? Now, what type of prophecy was the Mare of the 2300 days? What kind of prophecy is that? Unto 2300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. What do we say? What kind of prophecy is that? It's a time prophecy. Okay? So the same angel that he saw in the previous vision, previous chapter, comes back to him, points him right back to the previous vision, whole vision, and specifically to the time prophecy of the Mare. And then what is the very next thing that that angel gives to Daniel? What is the next thing he says to him? 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. What kind of prophecy is the 70 weeks? It's a time prophecy as well. He points him right back to the time prophecy of the previous vision, and then he gives him another time prophecy. Okay, so can you see how we're linking Daniel 9, that explanation in Daniel 9, to what was not explained in Daniel 8? Can you see how he's pointing him right back there? Other links exist between these chapters, and we'll look at them more, but the crucial thing is to see the links between these two chapters. Now, we're going to look now at this Demare. We're going to look now at the 70-week prophecy of Daniel 9, because that's given as helping to explain what was not explained in Daniel 8. Okay, is this clear so far? Now, let's look at this. The first line starts out, Daniel 9, 24 through 27. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. That's the King James translation. Now, people who argue against our message, they say the word is, we say the literal root there, the real word is really cut off. The 70 weeks are cut off. And as you'll see, only place they could possibly be cut off from are is the larger time prophecy. But people say, no, the word is not cut off, it's determined. Therefore, you don't cut off the 70 weeks from the 2300 days. Therefore, they're not linked. Therefore, blah, 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 1844 is, you know, it's fairy tales. Now, what about that word? What about the word there? What is the better translation? Determined or cut off? Well, unfortunately, the word that's used there, the root word there is hatak. Okay, now that's a word that is, unfortunately, it's not found anywhere else in the Bible. What we would normally do is to say, okay, here's where, let's go back and we'll pull out our concordance and our lexicons and we'll see, well, it's used in Genesis to mean this, and it's used in Deuteronomy to mean this, and maybe you could find its use in a book, in a later book about the time of Daniel, perhaps in Jeremiah or something, and compare it, see how it's used, context, see how it's translated, and then we can get an idea of what the word meant. Well, we can't do that with hatak, because it's not used anywhere else in the Bible. So we have a problem. Now, it's interesting, though, because a number of other words that can be translated determined or decreed and actually are translated that way are found in the Bible, even in Daniel. And they use a completely different word. They don't use hatak. They use more common words. So the question is, why is this more obscure word used here? What does this word mean? Why wasn't a more common translation, common word given to mean determined or decreed, if that's what it was supposed to mean? However, though the word hatak doesn't appear in the Hebrew Bible, it does appear numerous times in the Talmud, in the Mishnah. And this is like the Jewish, how can you describe it? I don't want to call it the Jewish spirit of prophecy, but it's like a Jewish compilation, Jewish explanation of the Bible. See, the Jews believe that Moses was given not only the written law at Sinai, but the oral law. The oral tradition, through centuries, this was carried down. And it wasn't until the first few centuries after Christ was this codified and put together in these massive volumes called the Talmud. I've got complete Talmud in my office, and I've got part of another Talmud. I mean, it's humongous there. The books are, imagine something that's maybe takes up four times the space of the SDA Bible commentary. That's the Babylonian Talmud. They don't even have the Jerusalem. They're not even counting the Jerusalem Talmud, which is not as big as the Babylonian, nor is it as considered as authoritative. But it's massive volumes of Jewish. You know, they go into the Sabbath and explaining the laws and so forth, and very interesting insights, as we saw yesterday. We could get at some of these books. Anyway, most of it was written in Hebrew, and though it's not exactly biblical Hebrew, it's very similar to biblical Hebrew. And the word hatak is used. It's found in the Mishnah. It's used in the Mishnah. And of the 12 times the verb hatak is used in the Mishnah in the verb form, 10 of the 12 times it refers to the cutting off of the different parts of the animals according to the dietary traditions. You know, the animals had to be killed a certain way. And in 10 out of 12 times, it means cutting off. It's only later on did this verb take on the idea of being decreed or determined. This earlier version is cutting off. Of the 19 times that it's used in a noun form, because that's what Hebrew does. A lot of the nouns in Hebrew just come from these three letter roots, which are the verbs, and they just change when they become nouns. Of the 19 times it was used in a noun form, 18 times the word hatak was used to mean that which is cut off. So again, this idea of determined or decreed is only a later, didn't come until later, this idea of determining or decreed. Strong's Concordance gives the primary root of hatak as to cut off. Whiting's translation translates it cut off. Jusenius, the standard Hebrew lexicographer, defines it as to cut off. The Chaldeo-Rabbinic Dictionary of Stoicism defines it as to cut away, to cut in pieces, to cut or engrave, to cut off. The earliest versions of the Vulgate and the Septuagint translate the verb as cutting off. Theodotion's Greek version translates it cut off. And I can go on and on. You should get the point. Cut off is clearly the proper translation for that. Okay? Can you see the point there? Cutting off. Validity of our understanding of it, the word meaning cut off. So this time prophecy then, the 70 weeks that we're dealing with, is going to be cut off. Remember, Gabriel comes to him, points him right back to the 2300 days, a time prophecy, then gives him a time prophecy of 70 weeks and says that these 70 weeks are cut off. Well, it's obvious what they must be cut off from. The only thing they could possibly be cut off from is the 2300 days. I just can't cut it off out of nowhere. So let's look, though, for a few minutes at the 70-week prophecy. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. I'm assuming the most Adventists would be familiar with this. If you're not familiar with the 70-week prophecy, in all seriousness, you ought to fear for your own soul. I'm serious. I mean, at this stage of the game, to be in this church with the light that we have and not know the 70-week prophecy, that would tell me that maybe my priorities aren't straight in my life, that maybe I'm spending too much time in front of the boob tube or something rather than studying my Bible. This is something that should be axiomatic to our thinking. It's ludicrous. You got somebody like myself in the church 8 years having to come and give seminars in 1844 where we should know this as much as we know get the Sabbath out of the Bible. Anyway, let's look at the 70-week prophecy for just a few minutes. Verse 24, 70 weeks are cut off upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression, to make end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. So it starts out with the 70-week period. Okay, they're given a 70-week period in which certain things are to happen. Anointing the most holy, bringing in everlasting righteousness, seal up the vision and prophecy, so forth. 70-week period. So we start out with this. Just imagine in your mind this block of time of 70 weeks. Now, again, I talked about the year-day principle yesterday. And as I said, as I promised you both yesterday and the day before, I believe, I'm not going to go into explaining now the validity of the year-day principle. When we're done, when I get done coming up with the date, 1844, I said we'll take a break, then we'll come back, and we will spend a few minutes, and I will show you how beyond question the year-day principle must be functioning in these prophecies here. I don't want to get bogged down into it now because I want to get done with this, and then we'll go back and we'll look at some of the detailed arguments that come up. But we're going to apply the year-day principle here to the 70-week prophecy. So if we apply 70-week prophecy using the year-day principle, we come out to 490 years. Everybody understand that? So they're given this block of time of 490 years. So the first verse says, 490 years are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city, for such and such and such and such and such. 490-year period. But the question is 490 years from when? They've got this block of time, but from where does it come from? Next verse. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and rebuild Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublous times. So right here, you've got the starting point of the prophecy from the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be, and he gives 69 weeks. So what you have here, not only do you have the starting point of the 70-week prophecy, you've got 69 of the weeks are already taken care of right from the start. Know therefore and understand that from the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto the Messiah shall be 69 weeks. So 69 of the 70 weeks are explained right there in the very next verse. So from the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, which had been destroyed by the Babylonians, until the coming of the Messiah, Messiah the Prince, which whom we know is Jesus, would be 69 prophetic weeks, or 483 years. Okay, what the verse basically says then, is that from the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Jesus the Messiah will be 483 years. Okay, is that simple enough? Command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah Jesus, 69 weeks, year-day principle, 483 years. Now, what about the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? Now, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time arguing over this because you can go around in circles on this forever. But what's important is that many Bible expositors, including non-Adventists, all have placed a decree for the restoring and rebuilding of Jerusalem in the 7th year of Artaxerxes the king that you can get from Ezra 7. I mean, almost everybody will agree on that. Some people will argue over the date of that, but they'll say that the 7th year of Artaxerxes is the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. That date is agreed upon, the seventh year, and it begins in the reign of Medo-Persia, just as the visions of Daniel 8 began with the reign of Medo-Persia. Now remember yesterday why we said, why isn't Babylon mentioned in Daniel 8? We've had Babylon in Daniel 2, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. Daniel 7, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. When we got to Daniel 8, there's no Babylon, just Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. So what you have here, though, so the Daniel 8 then starts out in the reign of Medo-Persia. And it's interesting that Daniel 9 starts out, the prophecy of Daniel 9 then starts out when? In the reign of Medo-Persia. So these are just more links, and I think that's why Babylon was not mentioned, because it wants to emphasize that this began during the time of Medo-Persia. Daniel 8 begins in the reign of Medo-Persia. Daniel 9, the time prophecy, begins in the reign of Medo-Persia. Anyway, when was the 7th year of the reign of Artaxerxes? When did this command go forth? What year did this go forth? You know, it was interesting, because the big debate in the scholarly world, because I didn't take any of this stuff for granted. When Adventists studied this stuff with me years ago, showing me the 70-week prophecy for Jesus as the Messiah. And I went back and I did some study, and I discovered that the big debate over the scholars is either 457 or 458. That's what they're haggling over. Well, I can remember about 8 years ago when I first studied this, I thought, 457, 458, who cares? It's close enough. For me, I wasn't going to worry about that. I was amazed because I went to secular sources and dug this out and found these dates there, 457, 458. So I wasn't going to hassle with that. But what about, is it 457 or 458? Now, some people try to place the date 30, 40 years later, but you have a problem with that. And we'll look at that in a little while. Why, if you put it 30, 40 years later, what are you going to do with Jesus? Or are you going to see this prophecy is locked solid on Christ? And I'll talk about that in a little while, too. Well, anyway, the debate between 457 and 458 really deals over which calendar you believe the Jews used. The type of calendar. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen this book. I can't believe it's out of print. It took me a long time to even get a hold of it. But I'm sure some of you know what I'm talking about. It's called The Chronology of Ezra 7 by Horn and Wood. And these men, using numerous extra-biblical sources, Ptolemy's canon and all these different sources, did chronologies, put together chronologies, and showed that the Jews used a fall-to-fall calendar in counting the year of the reign of Artaxerxes. And if you use the fall-to-fall calendar, you come up with the year 457 as the starting point of that date. Now again, this is not just Adventists who see 457. You can find even non-Adventists accepting 457 BC as the starting point of the 70-week prophecy. Now again, I don't want to get bogged down in a whole long thing about that because there's a lot of information that's out there on this. But we see 457 BC then as the starting date of the 70-week prophecy. So what do we have? We say that from the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, 457 BC, until the Messiah, the Prince, Jesus, is going to be 483 years. Okay? Can you see where we got that so far? We say that from the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, 457 BC, until the Messiah, the Prince, Jesus, is going to be 483 years. Okay? Can you see where we got that so far? Command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, 457, until the Messiah, the Prince, Jesus, shall be 483 years. So if you abuse your calendar, you come up to the date 27 AD. Now remember, if you're just doing plain math, if you're not looking at a calendar, remember the calendar you're using has no zero year. So just remember that the way the regular numbers does. If you use the way the regular numeral system does, you'll come up to 26 AD because you've got that zero year in there. But on a calendar, you don't. You go from one to one. So you just yank that one zero year out and that'll bring you to 27 AD when we know that Jesus was baptized. Therefore, from the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, 457 BC, until the coming of Jesus, the Messiah, would be 483 years or to 27 AD. We know that in 27 AD, Jesus was baptized and he began his ministry. And if you could just look at number 17 on your chart, and I'll put it up here for you to look at. We'll look at this chart a little longer. 457 BC, 483 years brings you out, 469 prophetic year weeks, 483 years, 27 AD. Now this takes care of 69 of the 70 weeks. We still have got that last week left in the prophecy. Now let's look at the next verse. And after 62 weeks, you know how that reads literally though? In the literal Hebrew, that reads after the 62 weeks. Okay, see, when I first studied that, I got confused because it said after 62 weeks, which is just 62 weeks. Okay? So I thought it was going to be after 62 weeks that the Messiah is cut off. So you still got that 7 weeks and 62 weeks. But when I realized it says that after the 62 weeks, so you've got the first 7 weeks, and then you've got the next 62 weeks. So it's really after 69 weeks shall Messiah be cut off. So it says after the 62 weeks, you've got the 7 weeks, then the 62 weeks, which equals 69 weeks. So after the 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince shall come, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with the flood. And unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. Anyway, after the 69 weeks, after the 62 weeks, which comes out to 27 AD, Messiah is going to be cut off. Now, let's the last verse deal specifically with the last week, the 70th week. Verse 27, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. Okay, 1 week, we're dealing with prophetic time, so how many years is one prophetic week? 7 years. Okay, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 7 years. We've got our last week right here. Okay, last 7 years. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease. and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured out upon the desolate. Okay, anyway, very quickly, it says, in the midst of that last week, of the 7 years, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblations to cease. In the midst of a week, which is 3.5 years, that's half of 7 years, comes out to 31 A.D., Jesus was cut off, crucified, not for himself. Now it says the sacrifice and oblation shall cease. They continue to do animal sacrifices after that. You still have people in the Middle East doing animal sacrifices. The Samaritans still do animal sacrifices. But after the death of Jesus, we know that they had no more meaning. They ceased to have any kind of importance whatsoever at all. Okay, the whole sacrificial system no longer had significance. And then we understand this, the end of the 70th week, 34 AD, we put that down at the stoning of Stephen, the official rejection of Israel as a nation, as a whole, official ending of the covenant relationship, and the gospel went to the Gentiles. Now again, we're just dealing with Israel, national Israel, not individual Jews, which I'm very thankful for, but just Israel as a whole ended, and we've got ended the 70-week period. Now again, there's a lot done on the 70-week period. There's a lot involved here. I don't want to get into a long discussion on this, but again, go back and study the 70-week prophecy so you can see this for yourself. Anyway, let's review before we go any further. We saw that the 2300 days of Daniel 8 was the only part not explained by Gabriel. Everything else was explained in chapter 8. In Daniel 9, there is no vision, just an explanation. Gabriel, the same angel interpreter that he had in Daniel 8, comes to offer him an explanation. And the only place we saw Daniel needing an explanation was regarding the 2300 days. Gabriel then points him back specifically to the Mare, the vision of the 2300 days, says, I'm going to give you understanding, and then he gives him another time prophecy, the 70-week prophecy, which he says is cut off. And the only place it could possibly be cut off from is the 2300 days. Be able to follow me on this. And we've just looked at the 70-week prophecy. So the point is, what we're doing here is we are really dealing now with two time elements. We're dealing with two time elements. If you look on number 18 on your charts, or you could look up here, two time elements. We're dealing with the 2300 days, which at this point is not given. We're not given a starting point or an ending point for the 2300 days in and of itself. By itself, from Daniel 8 alone, there's no beginning or ending point. It just says, unto 2300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. That's the one time prophecy that we're dealing with. The other time prophecy that we're dealing with is the 70-week prophecy. We are where we are given a definite starting point, a prophecy that is centered on Jesus Christ Himself. And this has a beginning point, and because it has a beginning point, it has an end point. 27 A.D. it begins, 34 A.D. it ends. So what we have now are these two time prophecies. Now, somebody once said to me, about 2 or 3 years ago, somebody, no, it was longer than that, about 5 years ago, somebody said to me, he said, Cliff, he says, I have no problem seeing how the 70 weeks must be cut off from the 2300 days. I mean, it's obvious they're cut off. The only thing they could possibly be cut off from is the larger time prophecy. But what he said to me was, and it was a good question, and he had me pondering for a little while. He said, I don't have any problem seeing what the cut off from the 2300 days, but how do you know for sure that you cut it off from the beginning of the 2300 days? Why don't we cut it off from the end of the 2300 days? It's going to be cut off from either one or the other, the beginning or the end. Why don't we cut it off from the end of the 2300 days? And I want as many loose ends tied up as I can on something like this. I want as many questions answered as I possibly can. And I thought, well, you know, he had a point there, and I thought about it. And after some prayer and some study, let's show you why it cannot be cut off from the end. If you look at number 19, or you could look up here, if you cut it off at the end of the 2300 days, that means the 2300 days will end when? 34 AD. If that 457 to 34 AD, the 70 weeks, comes at the end of the longer period, the 2300 days, therefore the 2300 days would have to end in 34 AD. Can you see that? That's when it ends. Now, if it ends there, where would it put the beginning point of the 2300 days? Well, the first problem you've got is it puts the beginning point of the 2300 days in 2267 BC. So can you see why this is so completely, Babylon, the earliest dates of the founding of Babylon. Remember we said Daniel 2 forms the basis? Everything Babylon, Medo, Persia, Greece, Rome. If you cut it off at the end, you have to put the beginning of the 2300 days all the way in 2267 BC. We're going back thousands of years. It's probably the time of Abraham, maybe even before Abraham. It's so completely out of the picture, doesn't make any fit at all in what we're doing. That's the first problem. Now, the other problem with that, which struck me just about 2 weeks ago when I was giving this seminar in my home church, this is the 2300 days comes from Daniel 8. Daniel 8, we saw, encompasses what? Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, to the time of the end. Okay, that's the essence of Daniel 8. The 2300 days is involved in this time frame. If you cut it off the 70 weeks at the end of the 2300 days, that would put the beginning of the 2300 days thousands and thousands of years, or at least almost 2,000 years, out of the picture of Medo-Persia. You see what I'm saying? The vision has got to deal with Medo-Persia and go to the end. If you cut off at the end, you put it so far out of even Daniel 8 that it doesn't make sense. And the final reason why you, and the most important one, why you can't cut it off at the end is, where would that put then? Where does that put the cleansing of the sanctuary? 34 AD, right? Now, what did we see yesterday? Between what dates must the cleansing of the sanctuary occur between? After 1798 and before the second coming. Remember we saw that because we paralleled Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. We showed how the cleansing of the sanctuary in Daniel 8 and the judgment scene of Daniel 7 were the same events, and it had to occur after 1798 and before the second coming. Well, if you cut the 2,370 weeks off at the end, that puts the 2,300 days being cleansed in 34 AD, and it just doesn't work. So then, the only other explanation, the only other logical place you could cut it off from is the beginning, which is logical to start with. So you've got these, remember, you've got these two time frames here, these two time prophecies, the 70 weeks and the 2300 days. Beyond question, the 70 weeks are cut off from the 2300 days. Only place it could possibly be cut off from. You can't cut it off from the end because it doesn't work. So the only other place it can cut it off from is the beginning. So that puts the beginning of the 2300 days in 457 BC. And if you put it that way, there's two ways you do this. You're all familiar with this. You can look at it two ways. You can go from 457 BC to 34 AD. You cover 490 years. That leaves you 1,810 years left from 34 AD because you've got 490 of the 2,300 days. If you add the 1,810 years left to the 34 AD, that brings you out to 1844. And remember we saw what time does a judgment have to occur between what dates? 1798 and before the second coming, 1844 fits that perfectly. Or, if you don't want to go that way, if you want to go directly, if you just want to start from the starting date, 457 BC, that's the starting date of the 2300 days, and just add to 2,300 years, remembering the problem with the zero year, and do jump that way all the way across, you'll come out to the same date, 1844, which fits the criteria perfectly. Either way you do it, you get 1844. Now remember what we said, the judgment had to occur after the cross, comes after 1798, comes before the second coming of Jesus. And 1844 fits these perfectly. Now you've got to understand something, which really amazes me. Seventh-day Adventists aren't the only ones, or hadn't been the only ones, who saw the links between Daniel 8 and Daniel 9. Numerous other Bible expositors did exactly what we do with it. They don't always use the same dates. They don't always come up with the same explanation for it. But let me just read you a quote. Here's from a fellow named Bishop Daniel Wilson, 70, who died in 1858. In 1836, he wrote this: "Therefore, the 70 weeks commencing with the giving or giving forth of this commandment, the 2,300 days of the preceding vision commence also at the same time, for the visions are one." So here's a non-Adventist, 1836, linking Daniel 8 and Daniel 9 together, starting them at the same point time. And what he did, though, Wilson put the end of the 2,300 days in 1847. Now think about this. Even if you want to debate me on the 457 BC date, even if you want to take the 458 date, or you want to take it 459 or whatever, you want to take that, debate that, you can't take it too far off from 457. Why can't you take it too far off? Because what are you going to do with Jesus? Okay, if you want to take, I'm jumping ahead of myself. If you want to take it 2, 3, 4 years off, take it 2, 3, 4 years off. Where does that put the cleansing of the sanctuary? Where does that put the culmination of the 2,300 days? You still have it sometime in the 1840s. See, if you want to go 2, 3 years off, if you want to do that, I mean, I believe 457 is solid. But if you go 2 or 3 years off, you still come up with the judgment, the cleansing of the sanctuary in the mid-1800s. And nobody else but Adventists are the only ones even believe that. Now, if you want to go and take the date 30, as I said before, 30, 50, 100 years off, which some people want to do, if you want to take it all this wacko dates and give it all these other dates, why can't you do that? Because what are you going to do with Jesus? See, this prophecy is based on Jesus. If you move that 457 BC date 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 100 years, then you have to put Jesus in a time frame that is so completely off from what we know historically when he lived. So really, in the end, the essence of this prophecy, it is based on Jesus. Jesus forms the basis of it. Jesus forms the assurance of this prophecy. Indeed, it stands as firm as Jesus himself. Now, one last point. And this hit me just a while back. And it really, in a sense, gave me goosebumps. The 70-week prophecy. Oh, therefore, and understand from the commandment, so forth, to restore and rebuild Jerusalem unto the Messiah. This is unquestionably the most important messianic prophecy in the Bible. It's the most controverted prophecy. The Talmud has a curse on you for studying this prophecy. Blasted be the bones of those who try to calculate the Messiah's advent. And the footnote points it. You know where it's talking to. I mean, unquestionably, this incredibly important prophecy points to Jesus. I mean, it's so, not more than any other prophecy in the Bible, this is irrefutable proof that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah. The 70-week prophecy that gives you the dates hundreds and hundreds of years before comes. This prophecy gives you the dates of Jesus. No other prophecy in the Bible at all nails, I don't want to use that phrase, No other prophecy of the Bible at all points Jesus, points out Jesus. My wife told me that last time I gave this, I used that phrase and she didn't like me using that. Points to Jesus as the Messiah. Most important of all the prophecies. Yet now think about this. When this really hit me, I have to admit it's almost scared me. This 70-week prophecy, as crucial and as important as it is, it's what? It's just a smaller part of the 2300-day prophecy. See what I'm saying? How important must that 2300-day prophecy be? If it's linked, if it forms the greater part of the most important messianic prophecy in the Bible. I mean, the Lord was not going to connect the 70-week prophecy to some unimportant date or something that deals with Antiochus Epiphanes or some totally ludicrous thing that doesn't have anything to do with anything. See what I'm saying? It was linked to the most important messianic prophecy in all of Scripture. And if you think about it too, Seventh-day Adventists, we are the only people in the world who do have any understanding of the 2300-day prophecy. We're the only ones that really do anything with it. We're the only ones that know anything about it at all. What the rest of the people do with the 2300-day prophecy, what the rest of the Protestant world does with it, is absolutely ludicrous. So nonsensical. And yet, so it makes me realize, as I said earlier, this 2300-day prophecy is a thing which lets me know beyond question that this is the remnant church of Bible prophecy. People could come up and bring up arguments about this, and we're going to deal with some of the arguments. But, you know, I told some people the other day, you know, my work, my interest is reaching Jewish people. And I would assume here, that does everybody here believe that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah? Okay? You're sure? You're real sure of that, huh? Okay. Well, all I'd like to do is I'd like to someday set some of you down with some of these Orthodox rabbis, some of these Orthodox Jews that I have to deal with, whose job is to do nothing but get people like me out of the cults, out of Christianity. And you think you've got it nailed? I don't want to use that phrase again. You think you've got Jesus? You understand Jesus as the Messiah? You think you've got it? Well, you know, I believe you. I believe that you do, and I believe that you're right. But I'm telling you, these guys, they'll bring up arguments and things that I almost guarantee you that you might not have answers for. I'm not saying their arguments are valid. I'm not saying, all I know is that I've dealt with these people before, and they brought up things that I didn't have answers for. And I said, I'll have to get back to you on that one. Now, the point I'm trying to say is somebody might be able to come along at some point and bring up some argument on some point about this that you might not have a clear-cut answer for. But the fact is the massive weight of evidence. When you go back and you study this stuff, the massive weight of evidence points unmistakably to this teaching. As I said the first meeting, if you were to use the Bible without any Ellen White, you have as much evidence. If you use the Old Testament, just the Old Testament alone, not even the New Testament, you have as much evidence for 1844 investigative judgment as you do for Jesus of Nazareth being the Messiah. And you can see the main prophecy pointing to Jesus is linked to the prophecy dealing with the 2300 days. Well, anyway, again, I stress, if you don't understand this, if things aren't clear, review, go back, study these things out for yourself. Sooner or later, we are going to be hit. We are going to be hit by a shaking and things that made everything before look like a joke. And I know from my own experience, being grounded on this teaching, being grounded on this has given me irrefutable proof and irrefutable confidence that this message is everything that we have been proclaiming and professing it has been for over 150 years now. Shall we pray? Lord, again, I just thank you for the privilege of being able to give this study and to get it more confirmed in my own heart every time I give it. And And Lord God, I just pray that if there's anybody here that's not solid in this, that is having questions, Lord, I pray that you'll just open their heart and have them to be humble seekers for truth and have them seek truth, not to try to fortify their own preconceived notions, but instead, but to come before you as a small child, realizing their own helplessness, their own need, and that they'll plead before you for an understanding of these truths and to know these things and to be so firmly grounded in these things that nothing will be able to shake them at all. And Lord, I'm thankful for your word, and I'm thankful for the clear prophetic outline in your word. And Lord, help us to be grounded upon the rock, to be prepared for the storm, which we know is soon going to break upon us. In the name of Jesus, I pray. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.